so serious.
All the toys, all the time.
I am the game and still getting trying to play you.
You know the rules. This isn't a toy.
But we bought it at the toy store.
We did, but the way I'm using it makes it an adult thing.
Are you ready to play the game?
Yeah! Welcome to the Toy Department with Matt Kolsky and Derek Madden.
Yeah, yeah.
All right, we're back. Time for another Toy Department.
A day late.
Yeah, that's my fault. We had some scheduling conflicts, and so we're here on a rare Wednesday. It's really sad because we missed a lot in the sports world yesterday. It's just action-packed. Can't believe it. We're kidding, of course, because nothing's happening because it's February.
And the nothing NBA's, good, that's for sure.
The NBA's on an all-star break. Are you, you know, we sort of talked about, maybe we'll talk about this. I'm just going to throw it out there before we get into an action-packed show filled with Black Panther and television talk. Are you into this 16-team playoff seeding idea?
Sure, I would love it. I don't know how realistic it is, but yeah. Why not? Always have the best teams in the playoffs whenever you can.
Well, but we're not doing anything to have the best teams in the playoffs, right? Because the way it's proposed to be implemented, it's still going to be 8 teams from the East and 8 teams from the West.
Oh, is it?
Yeah.
Oh, I thought it was just seeding everybody 1 through 16.
So, yeah, it's 8 teams from the West and 8 teams from the East seeded 1 through 16. That's what it is.
Oh.
So,
well, even so, I mean, it's a half measure, but it's fine.
It's a sticking point for me a little bit. And then the other part of this, and maybe they've addressed
it. Throw the baby out with the bathwater.
I haven't heard of it. Is like, are you balancing the schedules then at all? Because if you're let's just say things are like they kind of have been, and I know it's changing some, but let's just say the West is significantly better than the East, or the East is significantly better than the West. It doesn't matter. If you have one conference that's better than the other, and the conference has to play each other all the time, comparing their record to the to a team in the conference that's playing a much easier schedule, it doesn't seem particularly fair, right? So,
I suppose, but it rarely works out that way. Right. I mean, you're rarely especially if you do the eight from each conference, you're not really going to end up with teams from the lesser conference getting better seeding. They're going to end up with worse matchups, right?
No, they're going to have better records, right? So they're going to play
traditionally
worse
that
teams than they
true.
Would have.
The crappier conference has had crappier records getting into the playoffs in recent history.
All right.
If you think about the really good teams to miss the playoffs with good records, they've all been in the West in the last decade.
Yeah. I also sort of wonder, they've all been in the West because now
that's my point. So it would actually move their seeds up, even though you're right, they've been playing tougher competition more often. It would move their seeds up once you got to the 1 through 16, not down. So they'd have easier first round competition in the playoffs, theoretically.
Here's my last point about this, and maybe I'm wrong. Maybe I've outthought myself again. Aren't you also sort of making the first round less competitive in this way, in that you have these series now that are sort of going to have broader spreads than you would
potentially
have had
both?
You know,
I think that comes out in the wash, because on one hand, you will have less competitive series between the 1 and the 16. You might have more competitive series in the middle, where, you know, for instance, some of the past few years, the Eastern Conference, the first round has been very, very uneven. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
So those teams that are not as good from the East will now be playing. Like, here's an example. The year that the Warriors beat the Pelicans in the first round, the Pelicans were the 8 seed, and it was a sweep, but it was a competitive 4 games. Each game was competitive, or 3 out of 4 maybe. So that Pelicans team would now end up playing the 3rd or 4th seed. And so the crappy Eastern Conference team that got blown out by the Cavs anyway would get blown out by the Warriors instead. But a team like the Pelicans would move up in seeding and potentially have a closer series against one of the lower seeds on the top end.
All right, but conversely, and now we've gotten way into the nerd weeds, right?
Well, that's what it is. But on the other hand,
let's say you're a 5 seed, right? And you're in the West, and you probably would have been maybe 3 or 4 in the West, right?
Right.
If you were still in the old setup, right, then you're playing the fifth seed in the West. That's going to be a competitive series, or maybe the sixth seed. Now you're playing the 12th seed overall, right? It's probably some crappy team from the East or a bottom feeder from the West.
Well, so, is it? I mean, let's be a less just competitive look series? At, you know, I this is hard to talk about in the abstract. So let's just do it
based on
now.
The standings right now. Okay.
Yeah. So right now, you'd have Houston as one, Warriors as two, and the bottom two playoff seeds would be the Miami Heat and the Philadelphia 76ers, who instead of playing the Raptors and Celtics, would play the Warriors and Rockets. Those series are four or five games under any circumstances. Agreed?
Agreed.
Okay. Now, the third and fourth seeds would be...
But wait. So hold on a second, though. Those series would be four, but wouldn't they also, you'd expect them to be four this year and under the current setup now, right?
Philly, that's Miami. What I'm saying. Yeah, under either circumstance...
Gotcha. Okay, sorry. Go ahead. Continue.
Those series are four or five game series.
Okay.
At the most, five games, you would think. Like, the Celtics and Raptors should club the Sixers and Heat this year if those are the teams, and the Rockets and Warriors would as well.
Okay, now the Celtics and Raptors are the third and fourth seeds.
That's right. And they would end up actually getting the Blazers and Pelicans instead of the Sixers and Heat. And those might be slightly more interesting series than the Rockets, Blazers, or Rockets, Pelicans, and Warriors, Blazers would be. Or even if one of them becomes the Clippers, right? Yeah.
By the way, the bottom of the West is insane.
It is. And that's probably a conversation for a couple weeks from now. But let's just play this out for a second.
I mean, Minnesota's in fourth. San Antonio's in third. They have five more wins than Utah in 10th.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah,
sorry. Everyone besides the Warriors and Rockets is moving all over the place.
Yeah.
But again, just for now, like, I think you get more competitive series from the Raptors, Celtics, Blazers, Pelicans group than you otherwise would have, where the other ones stay basically the same. Then if we sort of play down into the middle a little more, the next two seeds would be the Spurs and T-Wolves, who would then play right now the Nuggets and Bucks.
Yeah, or Pacers.
Which, again, like, that's instead of Cavs, Bucks. Like, I'm not sure it appreciably changes the competitiveness of those middle series.
By the same token,
Timberwolves Thunder, yeah, that's going to be super competitive. But those teams are likely to square off with the Pacers, Wizards, Cavaliers.
Yeah. I don't know. My brain has melted a little bit trying to figure all this out.
Yeah, I mean, I think when it comes down to most of the stuff that concerns people, this would keep things the same. Like I said, though, it's a half measure. Because if I'm the commissioner, my real goal of changing playoff seeding would be to get the right teams into the playoffs.
Yeah, to me. I think you're going to have a tough time getting the owners to agree in the weaker conference, knowing that they might lose home playoff games.
Yeah, perhaps. But I guess I would just say the right thing to do in any circumstance. But you know, right now for the NBA, if you're trying to think outside the box and how do we improve an already thriving and improving league, I think you have to ask yourself the question, what is the point of conferences and divisions at all in a world where everyone's flying private and we've cut down 4-hour games in 5 nights and we're cutting down road back-to-backs? Like, what does it really mean? Shouldn't we all just play together and then have the best teams go to the playoffs 1-16? Yeah. And that would be what I would be striving for.
Maybe.
But that's a lot. And change doesn't usually come in those full steps all at once.
I try to address the tanking first. Personally,
tanking doesn't bother me at all, but that's a topic for another time.
I agree. It doesn't bother me either, but I think we're in the minority on that. All right. If you really want to get down to what people care about and addressing what people care about, we should be talking about.
Yeah.
We should be talking about Black Panther, right? Because that is what people care about in the year of our Lord 2018.
People are caring in droves about Black Panther.
So I'm curious. When did you see Black Panther, and what, like, how crowded was the theater? Tell me about your Black Panther experience.
I saw it Friday afternoon at 1 p.m. The theater was completely packed, and for what it's worth, at the Emeryville, California AMC theater, the demographic was noticeably skewed.
Noticeably skewed towards
people of color.
Okay.
Like, I go to movies at this theater at least once every 2 weeks, and I would say, ballparking it without ever paying much attention, you know, at best, I'll see 2 to 5 people of color in that theater. And this was a majority black crowd.
Gotcha.
At 1 p.m. on a Friday of the opening weekend.
Yeah, there was a point I saw this in the suburbs out here in a town called Oakdale. And I could be wrong. I've been to this theater twice, and once was the first Star Wars reboot. But I had this thought of like, God, this might be the most people of color ever in Oakdale. Like, yep. And there were people who, you know, this area has a lot of Africans.
Uh-huh.
And a lot of people like wearing like native garb.
Totally.
And like full on representing, and people are, you know, just pumped up. And
yep.
and you definitely felt like you're, oh, I'm in a moment right now. Like I'm witnessing a moment. And it's really, to me, it's almost hard to say. You know, it's kind of incalculable how much that sort of adds to your experience watching the movie, right?
Yeah, it's calculable to say how much it adds to the domestic gross box office, though.
Yeah, that's pretty calculable. I agree.
It's a pretty strong argument for more black stuff in theaters, right? I mean, like, it, you know, and this is probably more interesting for you to talk about than for me, but like, is it, if the proof wasn't already in the pudding from other movies involving diversity of the past 5 years, this is pretty much the ruling statement. The gavel has dropped on we need more movies telling stories of people who are not white.
Well, I mean, I would personally love to say that is true. But at least in my experience, right, I mean, movies, you know, one of the reasons why superhero movies are so prevalent in general, and we're sort of gearing everything in this sort of take care of teenage boys first, get the other four quadrant next kind of movie making, is because international box office is so important now, and so many of these movies have foreign investment, right?
Well, okay, hold on, let me stop you, because that's really a separate discussion about the business of Hollywood.
Yeah.
Let me put it this way.
I mean, but we talked, you know, you
America
brought up in a dollars
to see these
context.
Stories.
Yes, America does. I think that's inarguable at this point.
That's what I'm saying.
You know, if the point is, well, you know, let's make more movies for audiences of color and turn on the money faucet, I don't necessarily know if that's really the case. I hope it is. I think it would be great.
Yes,
it is.
You're right.
I don't know that it is.
That's a separate discussion about the economics of Hollywood, which are frustrating because, yes, there are entire production companies dedicated to making the sort of movie that no one cares about here because they make a ton of money overseas, and that is a functional business model. But just in terms of, like, any notion that, like, people are the masses are somehow put off by stories of diversity is absurd. And America wants to see this kind of story. The other thing it says to me, and it's hard to judge how much this affects like opening weekend dollars, because plenty of movies I think are terrible made plenty of opening weekend dollars. But, and this is also where I'm interested to hear your perspective, as a guy who does not especially like superhero movies.
This movie knocked 50 Shades Freed out of the number one perch, just to prove your point there.
Right. Yeah. But I will say, this to me, unlike some of the other superhero movies of the last few years that I've loved, like Deadpool or Logan, this is very much a superhero movie. It is within the framework of superhero film. It has many of the, I don't know if tropes is quite the right word, but just sort of the stuff that comes with superhero flicks, it's all here. It's just better. Everything's done really well. Thematically, it's deeper and richer and more resonant than most superhero movies, probably than any superhero movie I've ever seen. The acting is at the top level. The writing and direction is at the top level. I even thought the action sequences, although, you know, the first hour and a half, there aren't many. I thought the action sequences that are there, and when they do show up in more full force towards the end, I thought they were better. Because I feel like we've gotten so far into this mold of blurry cartoons flashing across the screen, exerting their powers, that like fight scenes and action scenes where I could actually see what was going on and like watch the people work was really cool. So to me, you know, separate from what this means emotionally to an entire group of our population, this was just an incredibly well-made film, I thought. And I wonder how it hits someone who likes superhero movies overall less than I do.
Yeah, I mean, look, it's interesting for you to frame it this way for me, because I feel like now I'm going to sort of come off like we're about to focus on the aspects of the movie I liked least.
Right.
You know, so I do think, yes, this is a movie that really fits into the standard superhero mold. And I think it almost has to, because it's aware. The movie's very aware that, hello, audience, you've been waiting to see this. No one has given you this before.
Right.
It's important to us. We think it's important to a lot of you, and we don't want to fuck it up. And
like, in a lot of ways, it paralleled Wonder Woman in that respect.
Yeah. Like, we're going to shoot our shot right here, and we know it's a big deal. And, you know, by that token, I think you have to do a lot of those numbers. Now, I would, you know, and maybe this, you've seen a lot more of these movies, and so maybe you're honestly better qualified to make that judgment. But in terms of the execution of those fight scenes, like a lot of that was really super uninteresting to me. It's, you know, here are people
like it
with awesome
the
gadgets and they fight better than everyone else. And now we're going to watch them fight. And here's the climactic duel and the train platform where they're just, you know, going to punch each other till someone punches someone the hardest. And then it's
okay,
over.
But I guess my question is, do you prefer, say, because you've seen the Avengers? Yeah.
No.
Wow. What big superhero movies have you seen?
God, it's been a minute now.
All right, well, do you prefer the style of fight
X-Men
scene in
movies.
Iron Man, say, where...
Saw Iron Man.
So, like, where robots are blurrily flying around the screen, shooting fire and whatnot? Does that appeal to you more?
It's not that I prefer it. It's just kind of all the same to me. It's just not very interesting.
Well, that's a separate issue. Because, again, I think we've established very well on this podcast that, like, you are stepping out of your comfort zone to see this in the first place.
Yeah. By the way, without trepidation, I was super excited to see this movie. So
sure. But we knew that the elements of it that run along the lines of a traditional superhero movie would be the least enjoyable to you. So you're not saying these fight scenes were less enjoyable than the average superhero movie. You just, that's the part you don't like.
I'm just saying, yeah, those fight scenes were not enjoyable to me. They were fine. They felt perfunctory is not quite the right word, because I do think there was care in their execution. I think they were some very interesting car chases in this movie, but they're still just kind of car chases. And unless you are your Baby Driver and you're just really, really going out of your way to make them innovative, I think these were more innovative than most, I would say, but they're still car chases. You know what I mean?
I don't know if they're more innovative. I think if anything, in a lot of ways, they went backwards with action, which I am saying is what I appreciated. Like, I think there was less CGI, and who knows, I could be wrong, but having seen it one time in the theaters, my instinct is there was less CGI, there was less pushing forward of technology and a little more returning to the basics of action is what
I mean,
it looked
Did you stay for the end credit stuff?
Yes.
So
yes.
I'm assuming you watched the credits, and obviously I don't have a great sense of the relativity of this.
Oh, no, there's always a bazillion like graphics effects.
There was
people.
There were like eight different units of effects people. So I don't know how much they were stepping back from CGI. It seemed like most of Wakanda was CGI.
Don't get me wrong. I'm not saying they stepped away from CGI. I'm saying specifically the style of the fight scene. This is we're way in the weeds here.
No,
but
we
specifically to me, the style of the fight scenes felt more like hand-to-hand combat that I could understand and see on the screen versus like a bunch of blurry digital things exerting magical powers.
I mean, look, I thought they were
at an insane rate.
I thought there were plenty of jump cuts and plenty of people exerting magic suits, but but you know what? It was that was fine.
It's all
relative. Because the rest of the movie is fucking great, and you know there are Coogler is clearly arrived as a star. The execution of this movie is near no perfect. The acting performances are excellent, and as origin, you know, story. I guess it's not really an origin story, but as like, you know, these sort of setup stories go. You know, I thought it was imbued with tons of human emotion and tons of thoughtfulness about this country and what it meant to the world and what it could mean to a people, and it was riveting. I mean, you know, like I said, the only times I could sort of check out during the action scenes a little bit, but I couldn't wait to see where it went and how it would end. So,
you know that Coogler and Michael B already have a new film in production about your hometown.
I do know that. Yeah. I knew they were working on another movie. I didn't know the subject matter.
It is called Wrong Answer. It's going to be written by Ta-Nehisi Coates, and it's about the 2009 Atlanta schools testing scandal.
Yeah, well, that'll be fun. That'll be very fun.
I mean, right now, I think Ryan Coogler is probably the director, certainly one of the three or four who I'm most excited to see the next project from.
Yeah. I mean, look, there's this exciting crop of young directors out there right now.
Yeah, no doubt. But to me, Coogler in particular is up there in the like Paul Thomas Anderson, Quentin Tarantino zone. I'm not saying he's as accomplished, clearly, but for me personally, that like when I see Ryan Coogler has a new project in development, I reach that same level of excitement of like, this is going to be awesome.
Do you feel that way about Damien Chazelle?
Not at all.
But I do think he's, I think it's a similar level of talent. I think Barry Jenkins, I think you could probably put in that group, although we're sort of waiting
to
see his next thing.
I agree with the Barry Jenkins, although he's an older guy, I believe. For Chazelle, I thought Whiplash was really, really good, but none of his other movies have moved me whatsoever.
See, I don't want to just dock him because he made a musical, you know what I mean, that by all accounts was really interesting and good, you know,
like, I mean,
in the same way that I'm not like docking Coogler because he made a superhero movie, you know what I mean,
like, yeah, but you, but
even though
yes,
I'm not interested in the genre.
Did you not watch both of those films?
I did watch both of those films.
And did you not think one was significantly better than the other?
I did, but I also hate musicals. Like, I'm tired of superhero movies. I hate musicals. That's a significant difference to me.
Fair enough. You know, I mean, 10 Cloverfield Lane, I guess, was very well received, but that's not like.
Yeah, I didn't see that.
It's Damien Chazelle has a lot of talent. The ceiling is high, but no, it's nothing like I feel about Ryan Coogler, who I've seen movie after movie be incredibly successful and thoughtful and smart and good.
Yeah, he's very good.
It's a different level. Hopefully Damien Chazelle gets there too. But
what about Ryan Johnson?
Coogler, that's closer. Although, you know, I'm not the biggest fan of his most recent outing, we've established.
You're right. I liked that a lot more than you did. That's true. Fair enough.
I mean, I really like Brick and Brothers Bloom and Looper. Those are all movies I enjoyed. Yeah. But no, I mean, I'm putting Coogler, and again, not from an accomplishment standpoint, but in terms of a my personal excitement standpoint, he's up there with the Paul Thomas Andersons and Tarantinos and Finchers of the world for me.
Yeah. All right. It certainly was quite an arrival. And you know, it's funny. It's easy to sort of think of Ryan Johnson as a young director. He's 13 years older than Coogler.
Yeah. No, Ryan Coogler and Damien Chazelle to that point as well. They're really young guys.
Yeah.
Really young to be as accomplished as they are as directors.
And that sort of puts them on the PTA track, I would say.
That's what I'm saying. Ryan Coogler is 31 years old. What am I doing with my life? You know, like, the Coogler and Chazelle are what am I doing with my life type guys.
Yeah, that's fair. That's fair. You're right. Ryan Johnson doesn't give you quite that same thing. No. All right. The movie's great. And the music is great too, right? Like in the film, Fantastic. The music is great, and then on the soundtrack, you know.
Yes,
it's great, and it also, you know, sometimes you have a movie project or soundtrack where they just get somebody really good to do music, and it's
right.
They make some music, but it feels sort of unconnected from the film.
Even this if it's good, like sometimes that. it's just like an album that happens to have been paired with a film rather than a soundtrack.
Yeah, and this feels like another instance where they're like, all right, well, look, we're getting our moment, and we're going to make the most of it. So let's get Kendrick and a freaking all-star team and have him do a bunch of songs for it. And my God, the SZA song and the Weeknd song are just fire. And I apologize for not knowing who produced those songs, but whoever did, hats off to you, sir, because those beats are amazing. And I just, you know, it's a rare and beautiful thing when you have something that kind of sits at this intersection of culture where people are excited and talking about it, and it feels like it could be a big thing, and then it really comes out and delivers. And I feel like this project did that on every score.
Yeah, for the record, All the Stars, which is the SZA song, which is just like it's the hottest of hot fire. That is Soundwave, the TDE producer, who has the top production credit on that. He also does the Georgia Smith song I Am, that I thought was phenomenal. And what was the other one you mentioned?
The Weeknd, the song that he did with The Weeknd.
Oh, yeah. The Weeknd song is Frank Dukes and Doc McKinney are the production. But Kendrick has a writing credit on every single song on this album. Yeah. So, you know, much like several other albums, some we could debate, but certainly like Dr. Dre's Compton, even when Kendrick's name is not on here, make no mistake, he is the creative director of what's happening here. And I mean, what do you even say about Kendrick Lamar?
You just look at the Spotify thing and you're like, oh shit, they got SZA. Oh shit, they got 2 Chainz. Oh shit, here's Anderson .Paak and James Blake. Oh shit.
Yep. Schoolboy Q.
Yeah, Schoolboy Q. Travis
Vince
Scott.
Staples.
The Weeknd. Vince Staples. Yeah, it's like anybody you'd want showed up, because who wouldn't want to be involved with this Black Panther thing?
Yeah, with the whole deal. With the whole deal. With Coogler, with Michael B. Jordan and Chadwick Boseman, with Lupita Nyong'o, with Kendrick Lamar, the whole deal.
Yeah. The other thing that I think was really great about this movie, and I think another instance of them understanding, like, this is our moment. We want to get this shot. We're making this for you.
Mm-hmm.
The role of Black women in this film and the women that they cast, so, like, inspiring and empowering and awesome. And there was this real sense of equality, but in a very easy, natural way. You know, every resident of Wakanda was strong, you know?
Yes.
Every single one. And
by the way, the nothing, not just with that, but like all of the thematic stuff that was happening, which was quite a lot by superhero standards especially, none of it felt forced or heavy-handed.
Yep. It was, really, really well done.
Also, just side note, I had no idea how much Danai Gurira looked like Viola Davis until I spent half of this movie going,
thinking it was Viola Davis.
Not thinking it was her, because, you know, she's clearly too young.
Yeah.
But just being like, God, it's uncanny how much that looks like they just put some, like, you know, anti-aging CGI on Viola Davis, like dead ringer.
I had not really thought about that much personally, but I get it.
And if you think, for those of you who think I'm just being racist, pull up a side by side. It's even in at their current ages, which has got to be 20 years apart, they are uncannily similar looking.
Yeah. So nice to see Lupita Nyong'o, like, not under a ton of CGI.
So good.
Like, so insane to me that that's what they did with her. More Lupita Nyong'o in our lives, I think, would be great for everyone. All right.
Indeed.
So let's should we stay black and go to Chris Rock?
Sure. I'm into it.
So Chris Rock is back with a new special. I think this is a situation where it's not like Dave Chappelle. You know what I mean? Where for a lot of people, he sort of disappeared from the public imagination for a while. I think the man's just reestablishing his stand-up bona fides, and I think it's pretty easy to say he still got them. You know, like,
okay, but he did leave the stand-up stage for a decade.
Yeah, for sure. It's been a minute, but it's not like you're like, well, God, I wonder what I don't have any idea what Chris Rock thinks about things. You know what I mean? I don't know. Like, it felt a little different to me in terms of that absence, which doesn't mean anything about how glad I was to have him back. It was nice to see him telling jokes, and he's really good at telling jokes.
Not only is he really good at telling jokes, he's so smart and thoughtful and insightful. And I mean, I know that this special has received sort of a diet version of the Chappelle out of touch criticism. And I just think that is so misplaced. Chris Rock just thinks about things in a deep, funny way. And everything he addressed, as far as I'm concerned, was well within bounds and not only hilarious, but again, insightful and clever. I thought it was great.
We have got to stop this. We have to have some understanding that whether it's Chris Rock or Chappelle or Bill Burr or any of these other people, they're using humor to try to get you to look at something in a different way. It's not necessarily about getting you to agree, and it's not necessarily about making a serious point. You know, like, and you can't treat this the way that you would do a little reading of a film or a television show and what it's trying to say about society, because these are jokes. They are by definition not serious. And I just don't – like, if we're going to do this where you can only tell the jokes I think are okay, we're going to ruin comedy. And I'm not – like, I am definitely not a jokes overall – kind of person. Like I get it. Like, we, you know, there are things in the conversation that are important to delineate, but are we not all adult to delineate when someone is joking? Like, I don't get these little microaggressions, if you will, against these comedians, because they're telling a joke that made me go ooh. Like, sometimes that's what the joke is supposed to do, make you go ooh. Or sometimes it's supposed to make you laugh at something that you're not supposed to laugh at. It's not the same thing as an endorsement.
Agreed. We got to be able to leave that space for people to think these things through on stage.
Yeah. Yeah. And you know
and
what?
I,
if you do
I,
think
look,
about
I
it.
Look, I understand that when stuff like Louis C.K.'s offstage behavior, or even for me, a couple of the things Chappelle said on stage can make it harder to accept working through things, because it erodes the trust we have for these people that I think is necessary for us to laugh at them thinking through things that are sometimes difficult or ugly truths.
When he's up there talking about his affair or affairs,
I think he's very honest.
Yeah.
And there's a certain
vulnerability that it takes to get up there and make jokes about
no,
this
and
thing.
I agree. And there's this thing where, like, here's what Chris Rock has to be able to do. Here's what it's critical that he can keep doing. is to go up on stage and say, I'm an asshole. I cheated. I did these things wrong. Pause to make a joke about how he probably could have cheated a lot more, and then go back to the honest reflection. It has to be okay for him to point out the fact, like the joke that he makes is, blah, 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 I was an asshole, I cheated. This is a slight spoiler, I guess, for people who haven't seen it yet, but deal with it. In fact, I ended up sleeping with three different women. And then the joke he makes is, every woman in here is thinking, three women, what an asshole. And every guy is thinking, only three? Right. And that's true. Even
that's,
for us
which is
guys.
Why it's funny, you know?
Yeah. Even for us guys who don't, who think we wouldn't cheat, right? In Chris Rock's situation, where God knows how many women have thrown themselves at him over the course of time. Even for those of us who think he is an asshole for cheating three times in 15 years or whatever it is. I think that, but there's definitely part of me that when he said three, I was like, man, for Chris Rock, could have been a lot worse.
Right.
Like that goes through our heads. So it's got to be okay for the guy whose job it is to poke at the things that go through everyone's heads. It's got to be okay for him to joke about that. Especially when he's also presenting us with a more honest reflection on the same subject.
Right. And in the same way that, you know, he can make this very real. And I think emotionally insightful observation about, you know, you have to be able to be the lead singer and play the tambourine in the band of, you know, that is your marriage. That he can make that observation and go, oh, yeah, that's real. And that's right. Then he can also make jokes about being the tambourine player, you know,
exactly.
Like, you have to be able to do both in a stand-up comedy routine because they don't go very well without the jokes. So
sort of defeats the form
if
you're not allowed to push the boundaries with your jokes. And honestly, again, I would go the step further, which we did when we talked about Chappelle, and say not only does Chris Rock have to be able to do these things, he's like well within the bounds. I think Dave Chappelle has to be able to do the things that make me a little uncomfortable. That's where the boundaries should be. To me, Chris Rock isn't even really pushing the boundaries. He's well inside them.
There's a whole bit that he does write about how bullies are a good thing. And look, I think we can all agree that in life, in serious discussions, bullying is bad. Right. But the counterpoint that he's sort of making in this bit, I do think there is some truth to when we try to deal with behavior or ideas or everything that are bad by simply sort of pushing them out of existence, then we don't necessarily train ourselves on how to deal with those ideas when they appear in the real world. And there's something that's lost in that, you know?
Again, I would go a step further than you just did. It's not even controversial. He's 100% right, and it's not even controversial. Not that bullying is good or bullies are good, and I don't believe he ever said that.
Well, he does sort of said, say we need some bullies, right? Doesn't he?
What he said was we need bullies, yeah. And what I think he meant pretty clearly is we need to know how to react to bullies because they are a fact of life. Right. Prohibition does not work under any circumstances, whether we're talking about alcohol or weed or abstinence training in the realm of sex education. Yes, in a perfect world, zero 14-year-olds would be having sex, right? Or who knows, whatever. Let's just say... For the sake of argument, in a perfect world, no 14-year-olds or 15-year-olds are having sex. In the real world, we got to tell them how to do it safely because they're going to do it. So, yeah, in a perfect world, there would be no bullies and everything would be sunshine and roses and global warming wouldn't be a reality and Donald Trump wouldn't be the president. But this is reality. So it's important to have conversations about things like, we need bullies, not because we're encouraging people to bully each other, but because we're encouraging people to know how to productively and successfully respond when inevitably bullies appear.
Right. I think people don't always realize how much they need problems. You know, like a life without problems would be so boring. Like the greatest feelings we have in life are overcoming problems and challenges, right? So, so often I think we want to eliminate. And now if we've gotten into some real philosophical stuff here, I think we just want to eliminate problems as opposed to learning how to deal with problems. And
And again, like for Chris Rock of all people to get into these things, like, do we not still fondly look back on, I'm not defending OJ, but I understand?
Yeah.
Like, that was pushing a boundary in the 90s when he did that. That was a boundary pusher. This special was well within the bounds. And I think smart, insightful, thoughtful, clever, and not edgy even really that much.
I wonder
not
how
by Chris Rock's historical standard.
I wonder how it would be for Lenny Bruce in 2018.
I don't even know. When you think about the now relative trivialities that shocked the world from Lenny Bruce, I'm not even sure what a comedian who was – relatively speaking, that out there would look like in 2018.
Yeah, I don't know. It would be hard. Maybe he'd be on the alternative comedy scene, like in Crashing.
By the way, Crashing sort of addressed this with the Bill Burr, the second Bill Burr episode.
Yeah.
And I thought that it was a really interesting and artful expression of it. And I think, you know, it was reflective of Bill Burr as a person and comedian that this thing that scandalized Pete Holmes, you know, the controversy, not what caused the controversy. Mm-hmm. This thing that scandalized Pete Holmes, Bill Burr was like, whatever. Yeah. People get pissed at me all the time. They'll get over it in 2 days.
Yeah. You know, I heard this phrase, and I think it was Larry Wilmore who said it on a Bill Simmons' podcast about agreement culture. And we're in this culture where we need agreement and don't handle disagreement very well. And I think it stems from some of this idea that, oh, you said something horrible and now you're off the island. I think we have to deal with horrible things. You've heard most of the things I've said on this podcast are about that, but it's not necessarily about this person needs to go away unless, you know, you've molested someone. Looking at you, Kelly.
Yeah. There's no shortage of people who need to go away,
but
let's not apply that ridiculous. Let's not apply the go away standard at a ridiculous level
to people who express ideas. I'll put it that way.
Right.
Let's just say you have bad ideas,
unless they're violent, you know, hideous ideas. Right. But this isn't even close to that.
Right. We can say you have bad ideas. That's fair. All right.
Yes.
Let's jump into AP Bio real quick, because this is the one I'm very curious to see. How you reacted, for those of you who don't know it. And I actually, when we assigned this for homework, I did not realize that this has not aired on broadcast television yet.
The free preview of the first episode is online, but I think it technically premieres next weekend.
How many did you watch?
Just one.
Just the one. Okay, so there are three episodes available on demand. And I've watched them all.
You may have a different perspective than me, but I have the perspective of this is more or less exactly what I thought, and I don't really need it.
All right, fair enough. The show is from Mike Shoemaker, who was on Saturday Night Live, I believe last year, and Seth Meyers, Lorne Michaels. It stars Glenn Howerton and Patton Oswalt. And I would suggest to you, watch two more. Because I honestly, I think that had I just seen the one, I would have felt like kind of like you, where I'm like, all right, it's a show, it's a network show, and you know, maybe there was a laugh or two.
Mike O'Brien, by the way, I think is
Mike
the,
O'Brien. Yeah, I said Mike. Mike Shoemaker's a different writer, I believe.
Yes.
But yeah, there might be a laugh or two, but this feels really inessential. You know, it's probably an innings eater for NBC.
That's exactly how I felt after one episode, yes.
Yeah, you know, all right, here's some people that I like. But I'll tell you, episodes 2 and 3, I found to be a lot more charming. And it leaves me with the impression that maybe episode 1 is a little bland because it's just kind of doing the pilot work.
Yeah, I see. What I was going to say was, like, episode one made me feel like it's a poor man's version of the Mick, essentially, or at least a second to the finish line version, where like I only need one.
Yeah.
And even that I could probably survive without.
I think the show is significantly better than the Mick. And I probably would not have thought that necessarily after the first episode, where I was kind of like, oh, yeah, I don't know if I'm going to keep watching this. But then I did. And
I will say, the first episode, look, Glenn Howerton is Glenn Howerton. He's pretty one note, but he's funny. The kids were the highlight of the first episode for me.
Yes, the kids are the highlight, and I think as it goes, the kids get more and more interesting.
Okay,
which I think is cool. The kids basically, you know, they're in AB Bio class. They're mostly nerds.
Right, because there's this teasing of his backstory that I couldn't really care much about. But if I'm getting more of the children, I might enjoy that.
They actually really like want to learn biology, and he doesn't want to teach it to them. That speech is big about.
He couldn't teach it to them if he wanted to.
No, he's like, well, you know, the guy went to Harvard. I think he knows some biology.
I mean, maybe he could read the book and piece a thing or two together, but he's a philosophy guy.
Yeah, philosophy is his background. Niecy Nash shows up in episode two.
Oh, cool. I'm into that.
As
you know, I like me some Niecy Nash.
As the head of the teachers union, who has a grudge like stemming from high school against Patton Oswalt's principal character, and she is fantastic. She's fantastic.
When is she not fantastic?
Yeah, she's always fantastic. But I mean, like, just chewing scenery. in this one, Taron Killam shows up a little bit later. Like the supporting cast, there's this gym teacher who may have made a brief appearance in the first episode, or not the gym teacher, rather, there's the gym coach who is kind of hilarious.
Yeah, I saw him.
There's a moment in a later episode where Glenn Howerton's character has to go to teacher jail because he's sort of in limbo. And, you know, so there's this like trailer that they just make them sit in all day, and he meets this other teacher in teacher jail, and they form this like friendship, and it's really funny. And the show gets weird, and I'm now definitely kind of wanting to see where the ride goes a little bit. So I'm a little bummed that you didn't get to see episodes two and three, because I feel like you might feel a little bit differently.
All right. Well, we could try to revisit it next week if that makes you feel better. You know?
It got through the apparently, at least per Wikipedia, the one episode aired at some point and got 3 million viewers. So,
really?
Yeah. On February 1st, I guess.
Weird.
So hopefully people will watch the show and maybe it'll be around. Because I think it's good to have network sitcoms, even if it's, you know, in like the Black-ish, like this is good, but I don't have to watch it. You know, but if I need 30 minutes and there's something funny, like, I don't mind having that. I think, and James Pony Wazik, I believe is the way you say the name, the TV critic, wrote something about this in the New York Times about how, like, I think a lot of Netflix is pretty good to very good, but there's not a lot of great on Netflix. And I think this kind of is in that sort of tradition of, you know, hey, this is like Showtime quality, like good, you know, which sometimes can be good. Speaking of which, you know, Netflix is kind of expanding into, you know, this idea of sort of becoming all of television, it seems like, right?
Yes.
Where you've got, you know, attempts at Chuck Lorre, CBS style sitcoms, some of them actually done by Chuck Lorre.
Still upset about that, by the way. Sometimes I see like an ad for Disjointed and I want to break something.
Well, it got canceled, so I think you're okay.
No, they're still advertising it though.
Oh really? That's weird. And you've got all sorts of other things, including reality shows. Leads me to the most surprising thing that maybe happened to me all week was you texting me in the middle of the week saying, have you seen Queer Eye on Netflix?
Not Queer Eye for the straight guy.
It's just called Queer Eye now. Even though it's literally the exact same concept. And
correction, sir. There are multiple non-straight men, or at least one.
Multiple non-straight men? Oh,
yeah.
Oh, you mean that they make over. Is that what, that's what you're saying? Okay, I guess that's slightly different from the original concept. But I mean,
are they all single in the original concept?
And I can't, like, I can't tell you exactly, because the original concept's been, what, at least 10 years?
It's been a while, yeah.
I can't tell you exactly in terms of all the people they talked to. I didn't see all the episodes, but it felt so familiar to me, and even that, like, the form of the episode in terms of, you know, they had the five guys. They were, I think, experts in the same five thing. They each kind of sort of do their thing, and then they sort of come back and watch them at the end. Like, I'm pretty sure that format was exactly the same as well. So, like, I mean, yeah, this is a, you know, I guess Queer Eye aired on it. Bravo or NBC?
Yes, Bravo.
Yeah, so this is standard network reality fare on Netflix, which, by the way, nothing wrong with that. I enjoy some standard network reality fare. You, however, do not. So,
I do not feel like this is standard.
What led you to this?
What led me to it was just people talking about it on the internet, that people who I like and respect were loving this thing, including some who had never seen the original. And I like a good, like, heartwarming story of love and change as much as the next guy. I just don't usually find it in reality shows. But I gotta say, I mean, some episodes are better than others. A couple of them, if a couple of the episodes were the average episode, I probably wouldn't watch again. But the ones that were really good, and the ones that jump to mind are the one with the gay guy, which you haven't seen yet.
Yeah, I've only seen the first two.
But which, like, I cried like a baby through half of and was so incredibly moving and just wonderful. And the first one with that old hick man, Tom, who serves them redneck margaritas, his title, which are tequila and Mountain Dew, and who finishes the episode being like, you know, I never hung out with gay guys before, and it was just the best experience, and I love them. And at one point, he, like, dives into a cuddle puddle on a bed with a couple of them, and just, like, this, frankly, this old-ass white hick man who most people would assume is less than open-minded and maybe doesn't want to hang out with gay guys, just having the time of his life and, like, sort of really having an impact on what he looked like and how he felt about himself. Like, I was honestly moved.
Yeah. I mean, look, this is definitely a reality show. I mean, I think you know, it has a lot of reality contrivances. I think you were seeing heavy edits. As I said, it has a structure and form of a reality show, but I would also say it's the best kind of reality television. And I started, being annoyed at having to watch this, mostly because you're so flippant about my reality indulgences.
I sure am.
But this show is undeniably charming.
It really is.
And the team of guys they have is great. And the empathy that these people show for whoever the person they're dealing with is tremendous. And I was really impressed with, not just because, yeah, all right, there's an expert in cooking and there's an expert in interior design and an expert in clothes, right, and grooming and all that. You expect them to do that stuff. It was really impressive to me how just kind of with these people that they were, that they really understood where they were at emotionally.
Yeah.
And were working on them from this whole perspective about helping people feel good about themselves. And I think so much of the inspiration came not really from making these people over or buying a bunch of really nice furniture for all of their homes.
Yeah, I was going to say, the one place where you really see the, like, undeniable both money spent to improve and also, like, actual work by one of the experts is in the home makeovers.
Yeah.
Because, like, yeah, they get great haircuts and you know, they trim
products,
their beards, and yeah, all they clean and stuff up. But, like, the one guy who really gets to work is the interior design guy, and he gets to go nuts.
Yeah.
And that is cool. That's more like a Bar Rescue level type of thing. But everyone else seems like they're as much there to help these people like live their true lives and embrace themselves as they are to do any particular thing.
Yeah. And look, and I'm glad you brought up Bar Rescue, because I was just thinking about this. I am known to enjoy Bar Rescue as a guilty pleasure every now and
then.
Yeah,
again. Me too.
I don't know
me
if we
too.
Talked about this in the podcast.
And I don't either. I love Bar Rescue at the right time.
It's definitely the same genre of reality show.
Yeah, we're working on you as much as your like person, or as much as your image and business or
but
whatever.
I do think this empathy thing is really the difference between those two. Whereas,
yeah,
like,
Taffer's tough love.
Taffer wants to yell at you. And yes. Like, I think he really does, like, he definitely will address your problems or issues in life,
yeah,
or like your motivation
you
for doing
end,
this.
But he's going to scream at you all the way there.
Yeah, I don't think he like really cares. I think he's like, well, I need to care that you're in debt because of this thing, or because your mom died and you're trying to make this bar for her. So I'm going to like use that as the carrot. Whereas, like, I think these guys generally want these people to be better people. And
yes,
the part at the end, can, you know, as potentially contrived and edited as they may be, when they have left this person and
uh-huh,
they're watching them in their new life, like, that's my favorite part of the show. Like, because you can just see they're genuinely happy for this person that, like, their life is better. And
totally,
it's, yeah, like, it's really, it's just really nice and feel goody. And, yeah, I did wind up really kind of enjoying myself, and I was not moved to tears, although I'm not above that at times. But
honestly, given our discussion about tears last week, I'm surprised it didn't get you at some point.
Yeah.
Because they tug on those heartstrings.
Yeah, no, they're going
real
for
good
it.
A couple of times.
They are going for it. And who knows? I've only seen two, so maybe later on. And also for
yeah,
me,
I would say episode one was one of the best ones, for like really getting you to cry. But the one with the gay guy, honestly, is just some of the best television I've ever seen, and one of the most moving things I've seen in a while.
Yeah, and look, I realize everything, including Black Panther, that we talked about earlier, is now made in Georgia.
Largely
that's for tax credit reasons more than anything else, but it really made me happy that this show it took place in Atlanta.
Yeah, so you probably like knew all the little towns there, the hick towns they were going into.
That was one of the things I was like, man, this guy really must be in a hick town, because like the first guy, because I didn't know the town. And I didn't realize at that point like that they were based in Atlanta. I thought they were, I was like, man, that's a long way to drive from New York to come down to this hick town in Georgia. And then now I'm realizing, you know, by episode two, I'm like, oh, wait, they're all in Georgia,
right,
and the loft's in Atlanta. And okay, that makes sense. But I did know like the restaurant that they take the Pakistani, or is he Indian? I forget which one is Pakistani. Oh, he's Indian.
I think it's Tan. The closet
who's Pakistani,
guy who's
yeah,
Pakistani.
I've eaten at that restaurant, you know, so like I definitely know some of the places that they go to, or a lot of the places that they shop at, which probably says a lot about me. But it's just, yeah, it's just nice to see, you know, particularly like in the South, and, you know, like there's a fairly contrived scene in the third episode. I watched like the first 10 minutes of the third episode where like they get stopped by the police in
yeah,
like small town Georgia.
That one was one of my least favorite. You'll see that guy becomes harder to love, but I will say I still cried at the point where they turned his father's old clothes into a quilt for the family.
Yeah. You know, and they play it for laughs, but it does sort of remind you of like, well, these are five gay guys in the South.
And they talk about it. They address it directly with a couple of people, because there's that guy who's a cop. And then later on, there is a guy who's a, you know, especially focused on his church. And so they, both guys are reasonably open-minded. So, I'm sure they wouldn't have put them in a situation where someone was going to be a bigot, but both guys openly address, you know, hang-ups they may have had with homosexuality at various points in their lives. And, Karamo, the black guy in the Fab Five, addresses his feelings about police in the episode you started watching. Like,
yeah.
And that's another thing, like, as contrived as a lot of it is, they do actually probably have more open conversations about some of these incredibly hot button, difficult to discuss issues than many serious news shows are able to have.
Yep. Nope, those guys are smart. They get it. I would recommend the show if you are looking, you know, you got a Saturday afternoon and you're looking to kill some time, which is.
I mean, yeah, more than anything, it's you said it early. It's so charming.
Yeah, it's charming and it'll make you feel good. All right, yeah. So with that in mind, I'm going to assign some homework to you, based out of this discussion. I'm gonna assign two things. One, I'm gonna ask you to watch two more episodes of AP Bio, which I think we covered, and we'll talk about that whenever that happens. That's probably a couple weeks down the road. But can we do Top Chef, which is coming up on the last two episodes of this season? I would like you to watch at least one episode of Top Chef. Can we do that?
You want me to go back and watch them, or
no.
You want me to watch?
No, you can watch the one that's coming on. You don't have to go. You don't have to go.
Is
back
that a Food Network deal?
That is a Bravo show.
Oh, yeah. Have I told you about how my girlfriend is in love with the Great British Baking Show?
You have not. She is not the only person that I've heard of who's in love with the Great British Baking Show.
I mean, if you like baking or cooking shows at all, it's a pretty great one because they're hilariously British. And yeah, the two ladies who host the show are my kind of idiotically funny about it. Just putting that out there. It is on Netflix, the first four seasons or something.
I have watched a couple because I also had a friend who's like super into it. It doesn't – like I do sort of enjoy like, oh, British people being British. But right. That's about where my enjoyment of that show ends. How do you feel about like just food, like restaurants and food and cooking and stuff in general?
I love food. Cooking shows to me are like background stuff for the most part.
Okay. All right. Well, I want you to check this one out because I do think it's the best example of the form.
When my girlfriend was watching Great British Baking Show and I could like have my computer and play a nerdy video game or something, I'm cool. And I enjoy having it on in the background. Chopped, I feel a similar way about it. I like having Chopped on, but I don't necessarily need to like watch it with rapt attention.
Right. So that's what I mean. Like, I think this show, and this is why I sort of thought of it with Queer Eye, like, it's the best of what reality TV can be. You know what I mean? It's a competition show, and it's still a show, and it's still reality television, but I think it's really good. And there's a reason that a lot of TV critics like it, and I think you should watch it.
Who's the people that host it?
All right, so the host is Padma Lakshmi.
Oh, I know Padma. Sure.
And you know, she's worth the price of admission.
No doubt.
If she never opened her mouth, she'd be worth the price of admission, but that she is eminently qualified. Like, she really knows food, and she gets it, and she's just a fantastic host.
Okay.
Besides the fact that she's amazing to look at.
What did I watch her host? I watched something that she was the host of because she ended up – she just done some Food Network stuff maybe or
– she's been around. And then Tom Colicchio is kind of the head judge, and he's a – you know, he's a legit great chef with restaurants in New York and L.A. and Vegas and used to have one in San Francisco. I don't think he does anymore.
Okay.
And also, obviously, he really knows food. They get literally some of the world's best chefs to come on the show. You know, it's a show that's created a cottage. Well, we'll talk about it some when we get going, but it's a show that's literally created a cottage industry because, you know, you watch The Voice or whatever, and those people win and whatever, and it's like the search for America's Next Superstar. You never hear from that people again. The people who not just win, but just generally compete well on Top Chef, use that visibility to get people to invest in restaurants and have sprung up. Literally, there are dozens and dozens of restaurants all over the country that are thriving and great and run by Top Chef alumni, including some of my very favorite in the world, and places like The Girl and the Goat in Chicago, which is a phenomenon from a Top Chef winner. So, So you know, it's a real show that's actually like doing real things, and yeah, you should watch it. It's great.
This is a thing I wish you had told me before I was in Chicago the last time, so I could have eaten at the sensational restaurant you just mentioned, whose name I've already forgotten.
The Girl and the Goat. There's a couple of different – she's got a couple of different ones now. She's got a whole army of restaurants in Chicago. So,
what about the Bay? Where are my Top Chef restaurants in the Bay?
Where are your Top Chef restaurants in the Bay?
See, you know, do your homework before you bring these food things to me. This is my problem with food stuff is like I want to eat it.
Yeah, no, that's fair. That's fair. I'll send you a list. We'll do that later.
All right. I'm into it. Okay, so that gives us AP Bio and Top Chef. I want to make you watch the Joel McHale Show on Netflix, which is really just Netflix's revival of The Soup with Joel McHale.
Which I enjoyed watching, although did not watch. It was one of those shows I taped on my DVR and didn't always watch. You know what I mean?
Is it? So that's what I was just going to say. What's interesting to me about this is, like, anytime you watch a Netflix show, you have to go to your Netflix and then be like, I'm going to watch this. For me, The Soup, which I always loved. I never watched The Soup and was like, waste the time. I always laugh. It's my kind of humor. I love Joel McHale. I literally never in my life made a special effort to watch that show. It was on either because I was flipping channels and bumped into it and stayed, or because, like you, I loaded a few on my DVR and then scanned past it one day and was like, oh, I'm going to rip off three soups because that's funny.
Yeah.
You know, never did I make a special effort or like a weekly effort to watch The Soup. And now it's a thing that, in order to be successful, people will have to choose on a weekly basis to click on it.
Yeah. Well, but yes, yes and no. People will have to choose, but Netflix doesn't ever have to tell you whether anyone's doing that or not. So, so you know, it's sort of, it's an interesting situation.
It's also more serial than anything I can think of that's ever been on Netflix.
Yeah.
Like, what else on Netflix is a real week-to-week thing? Anything else like that, it's like an artificial rollout.
Right. Well, I think this is more of sort of the Netflix trying to just be television. I got to say, there were a lot of shows doing The Soup thing when The Soup was on.
Yes.
And I think I was more of a Best Week Ever guy than The Soup.
I like The Soup. Joel McHale is my style. The like cynical, sardonic thing. I'm into that.
I like Joel McHale. I loved Community. But I don't know. I think that there was a lot of comic talent that came through Best Week Ever. You know what I mean? Like, there's some really funny people that were on that show.
Yeah. I'm not hating. And I even think Tosh has his moments, but Joel McHale is my favorite of the bunch.
Yeah. Fair enough. Fair enough. All right, so we're watching that. Anything else you want to throw out at me? Because really now, when I think about, okay, I have a few minutes and I'm on television, you know, I got some television. Like, the thought process goes, what sports are there? What is on my DVR? And, you know, what do I have to watch for this podcast? Like, those are basically the three things that I consider. So, so what else do I got to watch for this podcast?
Well, interestingly, you know, we are heading down the home stretch of the NBA season, so that will become interesting sooner than later. I'm not sure that's next week. Let me throw this at you, just because it's the season 4 premieres, I believe, on Monday. Did you ever watch iZombie? Have we ever talked iZombie on the show?
I can't remember if we did, or you just tried to get me to do it, and I never jumped in.
Well, I mean, listen, you appreciate Veronica Mars, right?
I do. It's not like I'm not anti-zombie, you know, although I have to say I have not completed the most recent season of The Walking Dead. But that's more The Walking Dead's fault, I think, than zombies in general.
Also, we're just mid-season, so, you know.
Anyway, no, there's still five of them unwatched, is what I'm saying.
Okay, but this is not... My point is not about zombies, actually.
Okay.
Like, you like Veronica Mars. Did you watch Party Down?
Did I watch Party Down? I worship Party Down.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So those are
you're saying
the
Rob
two...
Thomas, well, I should watch.
Yes.
What you're saying.
Those are the two most notable creations of the writer and showrunner Rob Thomas, whose current project is iZombie. And frankly, it is very much a zombie Veronica Mars with the comic sensibility of, like, Party Down.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I really think, although on its surface I can see why it wouldn't be super appealing to you, its bones, the actual meat of it, is right up your alley, I think.
And look, I know that I enjoyed Veronica Mars quite a bit. Veronica Mars aired on the CW, but I think part of it is just I'm sort of loathe to... I'm like, oh, CW. But you're right.
Yeah, but think of all the shows in that...
I know. I'll
CW check
it out.
Fame that we've enjoyed,
and I liked Crazy Ex-Girlfriend and Jane the Virgin, and they were
yeah, exactly. Like, and I think iZombie although I really do love Jane the Virgin, the most recent episode had a scene where Jane took her grandma to the sex shop that was literally one of the funniest things I've seen on television in this early part of the year. But I think iZombie is probably the best of them all from an overall show standpoint. I really like that show.
Okay.
So maybe just let's I don't know how the season four premiere will hit you, but maybe let's just hop in and see what happens.
I'll check it out because now I'm just mostly annoyed that you asked if I
liked
Party
Down. Beginning. You're welcome to.
Did I like Party Down? Come on, man.
I just don't know who even saw it, but obviously I think it's one of the best, most underwatched shows in television
it's
history.
It's amazing. Yeah. I would do an entire podcast series. Like we could create a separate podcast that where we just broke down Party Down, and I would totally be into that.
Just do a podcast down.
Yeah, podcast down.
It would only be like 20 episodes, but maybe we should consider that.
Yeah, or maybe it'll be like that Adam Scott YouTube podcast.
Talking YouTube to me?
Yeah, where they somehow got like 40 episodes out of YouTube's catalog. By the way, I don't know if you've heard, they're coming back to do REM.
There is Scott and Scott. Significantly more U2 than there is Party Down. Yeah. Also, did you know that podcast, I believe, was born out of, or at least born alongside, one of my favorite podcasts, RIP, Harris Whittles, which is...
Analyze Fish.
Analyze Fish.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, our podcast is really just another version of that, right?
Yeah, basically.
Just one long conversation where you try to convince me that fish is good, and I go, no.
That's more or less what's happening. I don't think you're as sincere as Scott Aukerman was in that pursuit. And I don't have any serious addiction issues, which is good. But otherwise, yeah, same thing. Yeah,
pretty much. All right. Well, I look forward to our next conversation about how fish is not good. And all these other stuff that we mentioned, and
don't get everyone to not come back next week. Next week we will not be talking about whether fish is good. That's our next conversation on that topic is still a ways down the road. Okay. So fear not.
Thank God. All right, are we done?
Okay, bye.
This game's in the Admiral refrigerator. The door is closed. The lights out. Butter's getting hard, the eggs are cooling, and the Jell-O is jiggling.
So long, everybody.
And do me a favor, have yourself a tremendous evening.